So we are, as I mentioned earlier, beginning this morning a new series in this book of Hebrews. And I suppose you might be expecting me to begin with lots of background information about this book. I'm not going to do that for the simple reason that when it comes to the book of Hebrews, most of the background information is unknown. We don't know who wrote this book. We don't know to whom this book was written. We don't know when this book was written. We don't even know what sort of document this book is. It ends looking like a letter, but it doesn't really begin, does it, in this opening chapter, looking much like a letter. So Hebrews is shrouded in all these unknowns. Now, it's true, of course, that our ignorance on those matters is of varying degrees. So with regard to the author, I'm not going to go there at all. It really is anyone's guess as far as I'm concerned. With regard to recipients, however, it does seem highly probable that the original recipients were predominantly Jewish believers in Jesus Christ, so Jews who had been converted to Christ at some point. And it also seems quite possible, I think, that they are based in Rome. With regard to the date, almost certainly it was written before the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. The book will talk a lot about the Old Covenant sacrificial system, the sacrifices in the Jerusalem temple. And it seems then very strange that if the Jerusalem temple had in fact been flattened by this point, by the Romans, it seems very strange that the writer never refers to that, that he doesn't use that as ammunition for his argument that the sacrificial system is now obsolete. And then with regard to the literary genre, the literary type of this document, I think it may technically be a written sermon or something like that, but it seems to have functioned in just the same way that New Testament letters normally function. That is, it was sent with a pastoral purpose to a church in order to be read out in the hearing of that church. So we can say those few things at least, but that really is as much introductory material as I'm able to give you. Although actually, of course, the most important background information when it comes to any book of the Bible isn't so much the who or the when or the what, it's more the why, isn't it? Why was this book written? And because then Hebrews is such a focused book, and because it's such a to-the-point kind of book, we are able to answer that question, I think. Why was it written? But I don't want to do so before we get into the text itself. I want to answer that question by getting into the text itself, because I think that even actually in the opening four verses, it will confront us to some degree at least. So we are looking then this morning at these opening four verses of the book. I'll probably call it a letter often for the reason that I mentioned a moment ago. Just before we dive into them properly, a couple of general things then about these opening four verses. First of all, it's one of those passages, I think, and we've seen this before. We saw it quite recently in a passage in Amos. We've seen it in Proverbs. You often get it in the Bible. It's one of those passages where you have a kind of symmetrical shape to the passage. Now, this is always quite hard to explain orally, but I'll give it a go. So I think we have the center point of the passage in those first two phrases of verse 3. He is the radiance of the glory of God, and he is the exact imprint of his nature. Those two phrases form the center point of the passage. But then either side of that center point, notice you have a reference to the creation. So at the end of verse 2, how the creation came into being. And then in the middle of verse 3, how the creation is sustained. So center point, either side of that, a reference to the creation. And then either side of the references to the creation, we have a reference to what I'm going to call the reigning Messiah. The reigning Messiah. So the middle of verse 2, whom he appointed the heir of all things. And then the end of verse 3, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. Now the connection between those two phrases and how exactly they testify to the reigning Messiah might not be perfectly clear at this point, but hopefully it will become so later. And then either side of those references to the reigning Messiah, at the very outer edges of our passage, we have a reference to divine messengers. So verse 1, prophets. And verse 4, angels. So that, I think, is how this passage works structurally. That's its shape, this kind of symmetry. Starting from a center point, you can work outwards and see the symmetrical pattern. So that's the first general thing. And then the second general thing about these verses, the theme of them is new revelation. That's what I'm going to call the theme. New revelation. It's one of the great tenets, isn't it, at the heart of biblical revelation, that God is a revealing God. He's not a God who kind of shuts himself off incommunicado, but rather he communicates with his human creatures, even after the rebellion of those human creatures in the Garden of Eden, in fact. He communicates with them, and yes, at the most basic level, he communicates with them in the creation around. The creation tells us things. But of course, he communicates with his human creatures in a fuller way in what theologians have generally called God's special revelation. God's special revelation, that which cannot be deduced simply from the creation around us. And then, of course, another great tenet at the heart of biblical revelation is that special revelation from God, it's progressive in its nature. So God didn't then just kind of offload everything he wanted to say in one great outpouring of revelation. No, he did it in stages. And that then is the background, really, to our passage this morning. And really what the writer is saying in these four verses is that there's been a fresh stage of God's revelation. God has recently delivered new revelation. That's what the writer is saying. And that being the theme then, I want us to notice three specific things. First of all, this morning, a claim about this new revelation. A claim about this new revelation. Because in these verses then, the writer is claiming that this new revelation that God has recently delivered, it isn't just another stage in this ongoing, unfolding revelation. It isn't just another episode advancing only in small and subtle ways on what God has previously revealed. This isn't just more of the same. Yes, there is continuity. He makes that clear. There is continuity with the previous revelation because at the end of the day, it's the same God who has revealed the earlier revelation and this recent revelation. This God who cannot lie, who cannot change his mind, who cannot go back on what he said earlier, who cannot contradict himself. It's the same God. So yes, there's definitely continuity, but there's also discontinuity. Really significant discontinuity. This new revelation represents a seismic leap forward, a game-changing development. This recent communication from God, it's on a different level from everything that he has communicated previously. That is what the writer is claiming. Which raises the question then, well, how is this recent revelation from God, how is it so new? How is it so different? How is it so unprecedented? Well, the answer to that question resides in those eight words he uses near the beginning of verse 2. He has spoken to us by his Son. He has spoken to us by his Son. In other words, the medium through which God has delivered this new revelation, the medium is his Son. Now, this is where the two outer edges of our passage are relevant. Remember what I said about the two outer edges of our passage in verse 1 and verse 4? They refer to two types of divine messenger. Prophets in verse 1 and angels in verse 4. And those verses are saying then that previously in God's revelation, in God's past revelation, these were the media. I'm using the word media there, of course, as the plural of media. I'm not talking about newspapers and TV channels and stuff. But these were the mediums, if you like. These were the media of God's past revelation. So verse 1 says that quite explicitly, doesn't it, about the prophets? Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. That's clear as crystal that this was a medium through which God revealed in the past, prophets. Verse 4 doesn't say it explicitly about the angels, but of course it's the reason that he raises the topic of angels at all. I mean, on the face of things, what on earth is the writer doing here? Why can he not get more than three verses into the letter without launching into the topic of angels? I mean, that's not normal Christian behavior. Most of us can hold a conversation, preach a sermon, sing a hymn without launching into the topic of angels that quickly. Does this writer just have an unhealthy fascination with these creatures? Because in fact, he doesn't just launch into the subject, he then continues on the subject of angels well into chapter 2. Well, no, he doesn't have an unhealthy fascination with them. He mentions angels because, like prophets, angels were a medium, a channel, an instrument of God's revelation in the past. In fact, he does say that quite explicitly, doesn't he, when he gets to chapter 2, verse 2, and he refers to the message, that is the message in the past, declared by angels. And there's, we don't need to go into this in any detail now, we'll probably talk about it later, but there is this idea that's referred to a few times in the New Testament, that when the law was given to Moses, it was somehow given to Moses through angels. Angels were the medium by which the law was given to Moses. And that then is what he's referring to there at the beginning of chapter 2. But all that matters then for us to appreciate just now is that in verses 1 and 4 of our passage, the writer is referring to the media through which God's previous revelation came. God's previous revelation came through prophets and it came through angels. And it's immediately obvious then, isn't it, that if this new revelation has come neither through a prophet nor through an angel, but rather through God's own Son, then this new revelation is on a different plane to what has gone before. I mean, even before you reflect deeply on what it means to be God's Son, just the very name itself indicates superiority. That's the point in verse 4, isn't it? Where he talks about the name of this medium being greater than the name of the angels. What name is he talking about? Oh, just God's Son. This is God's Son. It's, in our context, you think of the name the Queen. And before you even probe, well, what is the Queen of? What is her commonwealth? And what is her scope? And how far does her rule extend? Before you even bother probing into those issues, just the very name itself is so impressive. And that's the point he's making there. That the Son, even before you think about what it means to be God's Son, just the fact he is the Son, that's his name. He's not an angel or a prophet. That itself indicates that we're dealing here with revelation. If it's come through a son rather than through an angel or a prophet, we're dealing with revelation that is markedly exceeding that which has gone before. I used the phrase a moment ago, game-changing. It's a phrase you often hear these days. And that really is what this writer is saying. That revelation that is coming now through a son instead of through a prophet or an angel, that's game-changing. Notice in verse 1, he says, long ago, at many times, in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets, but recently he has spoken to us by his son. No, it's not what he says. But now, in this next stage of the unfolding revelation, he has spoken to us by his son. No, that's not what he says. In these last days, he has spoken to us by his son. That's a phrase that is being taken from the Old Testament. You go to passages like Isaiah chapter 2, verse 2, Daniel 10, 14, Micah 4, verse 1, Hosea 3, verse 5, and unfortunately, the ESV renders it latter days, but in the Greek Old Testament, it's exactly the same phrase that we have here in Hebrews 1, 2, last days. And you see, the Old Testament saints then, they looked forward to a different epoch. An epoch in which the very end of time itself would be within touching distance. An epoch, in fact, when the end itself would, as it were, cast its shadow over the present. The last days, they called that epoch. And this writer is saying that if new revelation has now come, not through a prophet, not through an angel, but through God's own Son, that means that that epoch has arrived. If God has spoken now through his Son, there can't be any further revelation beyond that. That has to be climactic. It can't be bettered, it can't be topped, it can't be improved upon. There are no subsequent episodes still to come. All that's left still to come once God has spoken through his Son is the end itself. The last days, those days prior to and overshadowed by the end, those days are now here. That's what the writer is saying. So that's the first major thing then to notice here, a claim about this new revelation. The writer is claiming this new revelation, it's radically distinctive. It's revelation through God's Son, the great climactic final communication from God, which ushers in the last days. A claim about this new revelation. Secondly, notice the content of this new revelation. The content of this new revelation. Now, it's worth asking, first of all, of course, what was the content of the previous revelation from God? The revelation that was communicated through prophets and angels, what was its content? Well, of course, that former revelation was voluminous. And so summing it up in a sentence or two is not at all easy. But I think if we were to do that, our summary might look something like this. What was the content of God's former revelation in the past through prophets and angels? It was this. One day, there's going to be a great king who will rule on God's behalf. One day, there's going to be a great king who will rule on God's behalf. I mean, you go back to the beginning, or almost to the very beginning, and that foundational promise that we have in Genesis 3:15. And what's it a promise about? It's a promise about a king, essentially, isn't it? The word isn't used, but it's a promise about a serpent-crushing conqueror, a serpent-crushing king who is one day going to come. And much of what follows then, throughout the rest of the Old Testament, is reiterating and expanding on that. As Sinclair Ferguson puts it, the rest of the Old Testament is just footnotes to Genesis 3:15. And let me just give you then two examples of this great theme that dominates the Old Testament. And you'll see in a minute why I've used these two examples. They both come from Psalms. So the first is Psalm 2. And Psalm 2 then talks about this future king. And it envisages God saying then, in Psalm 2 verse 6, it envisages God saying, "As for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill." So that's one example. The other example is Psalm 110. And Psalm 110 also talks about this future king, and it in fact addresses this future king. Verse 2, "The Lord sends forth from Zion your mighty scepter, rule in the midst of your enemies." So I'm saying then that that's the content of God's previous revelation. One day, there's going to be a great king who will rule on God's behalf. So what then is the content of this new revelation? Well, it's this. There is now a great king ruling on God's behalf. There is now a great king ruling on God's behalf. Now, we've talked then already about the outer edges of our passage. Let's move in from the outer edges. Move in a little bit further. And remember I said then that we have these two references to what I call the reigning Messiah. So the first is that phrase in the middle of verse 2, "whom he appointed the heir of all things." Now, here's my question. Where does that language come from? Well, that language comes from Psalm 2 that I've just alluded to. Because verse 8 of Psalm 2 envisages God saying to that future king, "I will make the nations your heritage," or your inheritance, that which you're going to be the heir of, "and the ends of the earth your possession." And then the other phrase in our passage then, kind of referring to the reigning Messiah, it's that phrase at the end of verse 3, "he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high." Where does that language come from? Well, that language comes from Psalm 110, the other psalm I alluded to a moment ago. Because verse 1 of that psalm envisages God saying to this future king, "sit at my right hand." And so do you see the point then? The old revelation, the former revelation delivered through prophets and angels, it said one day there's going to be a great king who will rule on God's behalf. This new revelation delivered through God's Son, it says that great king now reigns on God's behalf. He has been appointed the heir of all things. He has sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. Psalm 2's longing has been fulfilled. Psalm 110's longing has been fulfilled. The longing of numerous Old Testament passages has been fulfilled. The king looked for is now reigning. And of course, we need to ask the question then, well, who is this king? Well, the answer is God's Son. That's made quite clear, isn't it? And so do you see the significance of that? This Son, who we've been saying is the medium of this new revelation, we discover he's also the content of this new revelation. He's the messenger, and he's also the message. Isn't that part of the significance of the other passage we read earlier on this morning? John's Gospel, chapter 1. And in John 1, then, we have this idea of God's Word. That word is used several times, isn't it? And of course, as Bible readers, you're familiar with God's Word coming. You know, right from the start of the Old Testament, God is this revealing God. He communicates his Word. And he communicates it by a particular individual. We're familiar with all of that. But it soon becomes clear in John 1 that this is something different going on. Because unlike in the past, here in John 1, the individual through whom God's Word is communicated, he actually is himself the Word. He is the Word. And similarly here then, we have again this coming together of messenger and message. Through God's Son comes this great declaration from God now. There is a king enthroned in heaven, putting right everything that went wrong in the Garden of Eden. But you see, in the person of that Son is the king enthroned in heaven, putting right everything that went wrong in the Garden of Eden. He's the medium and he's the content. So what is the content of this new revelation? The content is God's Son reigns from heaven. Although do just notice too that additional touch in verse 3, that the path to his coronation was via making purification for sins. In other words, it was only through acting as a priest that he could subsequently be enthroned as a king. And that little touch is just left hanging there for the moment, isn't it, by the writer? But of course it will be developed at length later on, but it's just left hanging there for the moment. But the important point is this: what's the content of this new revelation God has sent? God's Son reigns from heaven. So a claim about this new revelation, the content of this new revelation, and then thirdly and finally, our confidence in this new revelation. Our confidence in this new revelation. Now, I mentioned in my introduction then that you can deduce why this book was written. And I'm not going to say too much about that this morning. We'll cover that lots and lots, God willing, in the weeks ahead. But it seems then that these believers, as I said, Jews who've been converted to Christ, it seems as though they are being attracted, and there are reasons for this that we'll explore later, but it seems as though they are being attracted by the temple and the sacrifices and the priests and all that old covenant religious stuff. And that's then why the writer has put pen to paper here. And from his perspective then, for these Christians to be gravitating toward that, it's a reversion to God's previous revelation, as though this new revelation had never happened. And as far as he can see, that's utter madness. And this is why then he stresses this claim, as I've called it, about this new revelation. It's not just another chapter. And if you like, you can take it or leave it and just go back to the former chapters. No, this is distinct. This is game-changing. This is massive. That's why he's stressed that. This is revelation through a son, not through an angel or a prophet. Why would you go back to revelation that's come through angels and prophets when there's a new revelation that's come through God's Son? And it's also then why he stresses the content of this new revelation and emphasizes this point that the old was all about longing for something that was still a distant prospect, this great king enthroned. That's now here in the new revelation. And again then, why would you exchange the latter for the former? Why would you gravitate towards an epoch of revelation that was about longing for something that hadn't yet come, when the thing for which it was longing is now here? And let's then just move into the what I called earlier the center point of this passage, because we haven't been there yet. And, or rather, the center point itself, those two phrases in verse 3, at the beginning of verse 3, and the reference to creation either side, that whole kind of central area of our passage. And I think that here then the writer again has this concept of media or mediums on his mind. And you see, he's already then taken this medium of the new revelation, God's Son, and he's placed that alongside prophets and angels. And he said, look at the contrast. God's Son, prophets and angels. Isn't it obvious? God's Son is greater than prophets and angels. He's already done that. But now, in this central area of our passage, he does something even more ambitious. And now he places God's Son not alongside prophets and angels, but he places God's Son alongside two other realities. Two realities which you would thought would dwarf anyone you try and place alongside them. Two monumental realities. Number one, creation. He places the Son alongside creation. Now, surely creation is going to dwarf this person. Well, actually, no. He says, you know what? The Son, it was through him that the creation came into being in the first place. He was the instrument through whom God created the world, the end of verse 2. And there is, I think, contained in that not just the bare idea of kind of instrumentality, but that which John brings out more fully in the passage we read earlier, that if the Son is responsible for everything that has been made, he himself cannot have been made. And that's really explicit there in John 1:1, isn't it? Without him was not anything made that is made. Some people have said, and lots of people have said, some people that come often to your doorsteps will say, that the Son is made, he's created. But John says there in chapter 1 that without him, nothing that's been created was created. So he can't be part of what's been created. And I think that idea is also inherent here in this passage. And that other idea, as well as the Son then being an instrument of the creation coming into being, but he also sustains it. And sustains it so effortlessly by the word of his power, verse 3. It's astonishing, that, isn't it? You think of, remember, as a child, we'd go to York and you'd see these street entertainers and they'd be juggling lots of items. And not just juggling lots of items, but doing it while standing on their head or riding on a bike with one wheel or just throwing a bit of fire into the equation to make it a bit more fun, whatever it might be, and making it all seem so effortless. But this is someone sustaining, keeping in the air not just a few sticks of fire, but keeping in the air every atom of the cosmos, every galaxy, every creepy crawly, every creature you've ever seen David Attenborough talk about on planet Earth. And he's keeping them all going every single millisecond. And he's not getting tired, and he's not out of breath. And he doesn't have to stop while the crowd applauses, like those street entertainers. He just keeps on doing it with words, simple words. Some of you perhaps will be going home after this and cooking a Sunday roast, and that'll be quite tricky, kind of bringing everything together. You've got kind of potatoes boiling over there, and you've got meat that's about to get burnt, and you need to start putting the pudding in the oven, and it's hard to keep it all going. And here's this person, he keeps everything going constantly. It's just magnificent. So the writer places him alongside creation. Is he dwarfed? Not a bit of it. He's bigger than creation. But then he goes a step further, and in the very center point of our passage then, he places the Son alongside God himself. Surely he's got to be dwarfed now. Well, he's not, is he? He says he's the radiance of the glory of God. You know how in our language we talk about the sun shining, don't we? Or the sun shining today. Of course, it's a silly remark, isn't it? Because the sun cannot but shine. The sun's always shining. Shining is part of the essence of what the sun is and does. And yes, then it can shine on certain things and not other things. It can shine on one hemisphere of our planet when that is facing it and not on another hemisphere. But it can't not shine. Shining is part of what it is. And in the Bible then we have this concept of God's glory, don't we? And it's described in almost sun-like terms at times as this brightness. And this writer is saying then that the sun, he's the shining of that glory. He's the radiance of that glory. And again, just as the shining of the sun, it's part of its essence, so the radiance, the shining of God's glory, it's part of its essence. I mean, God's glory can shine on one thing and not another. It can inhabit the Jerusalem temple and then it can withdraw from the Jerusalem temple. But it can't not shine. It can't not radiate. The radiation is part of the thing itself. And the sun then is part of the very essence of God's glory. That's what the writer is saying. Then he goes on that he's the exact imprint of his nature. In other words, everything that it means to be God, everything that it means that is in the Father, all his attributes, whether you think of power, whether you think of wisdom, whether you think of compassion, whether you think of holiness, all his attributes are replicated in this person, the Son. And so he's not dwarfed even by God. He is God. There's full equality with God. That's what the writer is saying. And he's saying then that if this new revelation has come through this person, I mean, forget the comparison with angels and prophets. What about the comparison with creation and with God if it's come through this person? Then we can have complete confidence in it. Don't jettison it for some previous revelation. That's what the writer is saying. Well, three very quick questions then from all of this as we close. Question number one, what's the source of what you believe? What's the source of what you believe? Because here were these Christians then, and they're being tempted to drift to a situation where the source of what they believe is prophets and angels. And the writer is saying, no, make that revelation which comes from the Son, the source. Make that what you believe. Make him the source of what you believe. Not prophets and angels, the Son. What's the source of what you believe this morning? Charles Darwin, Richard Dawkins, the pop singers, novelists of our day, the politicians. Where are you getting your belief system from? This writer is saying, get it from the most impressive person you can get it from. And the most impressive person you can get it from is the one who is the radiance of God's glory, the exact imprint of his nature, the sustainer of the universe. You can't get a higher source of your worldview than Jesus. Don't get your thoughts and your opinions from little people who die, like Derek Walcott and Chuck Berry, who have died in these past hours, but get it from Jesus. What's the source of what you believe? Second question, have you been purified? Have you been purified? Because, as I said, that little touch, it is a little touch, and it's left hanging, and it will be developed later, but we shouldn't just skip completely over it, because it's beautiful, isn't it? After making purification for sins. Fascinating, it's the same verb as through whom he made the world. It should be made at the end of verse 2. And here it's making purification for sins. And in a way, isn't the Son's making of purification for sins an even greater making than his making of the universe itself? With the universe itself, he's starting from nothing. With making purification, he's starting from sin and guilt and hell deservingness. But he's made purification for sins through his own blood on the cross. Have you been purified through faith in Jesus Christ? You'll one day stand before God. Are you going to stand before God filthy in the muck of your foolish misdeeds, or clean through the blood of Jesus Christ? And then the last and most obvious question, do you worship the Son of God? Not do you admire him? Not do you respect him? Not do you count him an important figure in history, but do you worship him, the radiance of God's glory, the exact replication of God's being? Is he everything to you? Have you surrendered your whole life to him because he's awesome and unsurpassable, and he owns you and he keeps you breathing, and you'll one day stand before him? Bow the knee to Jesus Christ. Amen.